From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump is defending his labeling of President Obama the founder of the Islamic State. Today, Trump told CNBC it was appropriate because he said President Obama withdrew troops from Iraq and created a power vacuum in which extremist groups could thrive. Trump also called Hillary Clinton the co-founder. Many analysts, including Lena Khatib of the Carnegie Middle East Center, say ISIS was born before Obama took office, as the Iraq military was dismantled following the invasion of Iraq. But this is just the latest in a string of controversial comments from the Republican nominee. And as Trump faces slumping poll numbers and is shunned by prominent Republicans, there's growing concern in the New Hampshire GOP that he has no field operation in that swing state. Anthony Brooks from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
Amazingly, yes.
This is what one late summer presidential campaign looks like on a Tuesday evening in Salem, New Hampshire. The walls are covered with campaign posters for Democrats, including Maggie Hassan, who's running for the Senate, and Hillary Clinton for president. Some 20 volunteers, including 15-year-old Matthew Allen, are making phone calls to voters.
So have you decided if you're going to support Hillary Clinton for president this November?
This is part of what Granite State Democrats call the New Hampshire Together Coordinated Campaign, a grassroots effort to support candidates up and down the ballot.
We've already got 11 field offices opened up and dozens of staffers that are working in every corner of the state.
This is Ray Buckley, the chairman of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. He says Democrats have thousands of volunteers working in phone banks like this, knocking on doors and organizing campaign house parties. Buckley says this kind of field organization can make a big difference come Election Day, particularly in a swing state like New Hampshire.
One only has to look at the 2014 results, where across the country, every purple state Democrat was in danger and many, many lost. But here in New Hampshire, Senator Shaheen was reelected to the U.S. Senate, and Governor Hassan, despite being outspent, was reelected. And that had everything to do with the ground game.
The Democratic ground game means cooperation between the state Democratic Party, local and statewide campaigns, and Hillary Clinton's presidential effort. By contrast, this kind of coordinated ground game with Donald Trump's campaign is missing, according to many concerned Republicans in this state.
If you are a Trump supporter and you want to get a sign for your yard, there's no place to go and get it.
This is Fergus Cullen, the former chairman of the state GOP. He's not a Trump supporter, but he's worried that a lack of organization in the state will hurt the rest of the Republican ticket.
At this point, we would traditionally have regional field offices being opened that are basically funded through the presidential campaign. None of that is happening. The lack of organization and funding on the Trump campaign means there is no organized get-out-the-vote effort, and that's going to have significant consequences down ballot.
The Clinton campaign has 11 regional offices and 3 get-out-the-vote centers and dozens of paid campaign staff members. By contrast, the Trump campaign has no regional offices, no get-out-the-vote centers, and a much leaner staff. But Stephen Stepanek, a state rep and the co-chair of the Trump campaign in New Hampshire, says he's not worried. I caught up with Stepanek at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
Let's put it this way. The Trump campaign has had an office in New Hampshire since April of 2015. Romney didn't open up an office until September. So we've been on the ground working hard well before he even announced he was running for president.
Stepanek acknowledges that Clinton has a lot more paid staff in the state, but he argues the Trump campaign has a deep database of supporters and a willing army of volunteers from inside and outside of New Hampshire, ready to knock on doors and get people to the polls.
And I've got hundreds and hundreds of Massachusetts volunteers who are coming now to New Hampshire to start working for us. I just was talking with Texas. They are organizing an effort. They want to send 500 volunteers to New Hampshire.
Trump has defended the relatively small size of his campaign staff by tweeting, "Small is good, flexible," suggesting it saves money. So part of this is just the way Trump operates. But Andy Smith, who heads the polling center at the University of New Hampshire, says there are historical reasons, quite apart from Trump, that explain why Democrats have a big organizational advantage in New Hampshire.
The Democratic Party for decades or a century had been the minority party in the state and didn't have access to people or financial resources that the Republicans had. And consequently, they built a very, very good get-out-the-vote operation over the last several decades.
Which is all the more reason that many Republicans in New Hampshire are worried about Trump's current effort in the state, but not this man.
New Hampshire is a battleground state, and Donald Trump knows how important it is to win that for the general election.
This is Corey Lewandowski, a New Hampshire resident and Trump's former national campaign manager and now a commentator for CNN. When I caught up with him at the RNC in Cleveland, Lewandowski deflected my questions about a weaker political organization and ground game in New Hampshire and suggested that it's always risky to bet against Trump.
The Republicans in New Hampshire, the independents in New Hampshire know how important this election is, and they will be fully prepared to educate the people of how bad a Clinton presidency will be.
But you seem to be saying that this is going to just be up to the voters as opposed to a campaign infrastructure in New Hampshire.
No, I'm saying I think the Clinton campaign should continue to underestimate the Trump campaign. The mainstream media has done that this entire cycle and continue to say that he didn't have a ground game, but he won 38 states.
And the first of those 38 states that Trump won was New Hampshire. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
Well, today the Drug Enforcement Administration announced that it is maintaining its ban on medical marijuana, meaning the drug remains listed as an addictive substance with no accepted medical use. However, the federal government will make it easier for universities to grow marijuana, which will expand research on pot. Joining us now is Ryan Nurz, who is the cannabis correspondent for Fusion. And Ryan, right now the University of Mississippi is the only institution legally allowed to grow marijuana for research?
That's right. And, you know, University of Mississippi, obviously pretty far from the epicenter of marijuana technology and pharmacology, which is all happening on the West Coast. It's all, you know, Colorado and Washington. And my understanding, you know, from insiders in marijuana world is that the quality of the marijuana that comes out of the University of Mississippi is very mediocre and very unnuanced. It's just this sort of old school blend that they've been doing for years. It doesn't have any understanding of, you know, the differences between CBD and THCA and THCB and all these cannabinoids that, according to researchers, are very important understanding how the drug will affect maladies.
So how big of a deal is this change from the government?
Well, you know, I think it's bittersweet. I think it's, you know, it's a little bit one step forward, two steps back. I mean, I think a lot of medical marijuana advocates are really disappointed because they think it's very, very clear that it should have been changed from a Schedule I to at least a Schedule II drug. And that's something that, you know, the DEA has been teasing out. That said, it's really important in the sense that all these research that's happening with, you know, the effects of marijuana on PTSD, on, you know, on a number of maladies now is really, it's really important that you get very good quality marijuana, that you know the exact amount of cannabinoids, the exact amount of CBD, which is a cannabinoid that really has been useful with epilepsy and certain other maladies. So now they can really fine-tune and get the quality of marijuana that, frankly, you can get at almost any medical marijuana dispensary in places like Denver and Seattle.
And when you say that people were hoping that it would be changed from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2, explain what that means.
Sure. So basically, Schedule 1 means that it has absolutely no medical value whatsoever officially under federal law. And that includes drugs like, let's see, what is it, heroin? Whereas cocaine, I believe, is actually Schedule 2, meaning that it does have some medical value. Hmm. And so, you know, obviously with 25 states, half of the United States are using medical marijuana. Not only have they said that it has, you know, medical value, they're actually using it under state law. So half of the states are at odds with this federal stance on things. So it seems like it's kind of a tipping point that a lot of medical marijuana advocates just think, come on, let's do it.
Well, since, as you say, half the states are already allowing the legal use of medical marijuana, and there are a number of other states that have that on the ballot this fall, as we've talked about, why is the federal government keeping its ban?
Oh, see, that's kind of a mystery, to be honest. I mean, you know, I think one thing is that it's just a lot. There's a lot of federal oversight that has just been entrenched for years. There's NIDA, there's the FDA, there's the DEA, and to sort of just change it all at once from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, and then also open up, you know, the doors for all those other 25 states that haven't legalized medical marijuana, would just become sort of a, I think, a bureaucratic nightmare that they don't want to deal with yet. So they're doing this more gradual approach. And I think it's a matter of time that it will become Schedule 2. But there's also people who think that the pharmaceutical companies are pressuring, you know, the federal government. So there's conspiracy theories in weed world about it.
That's Ryan Nerz, who is cannabis correspondent for Fusion. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Good to be here.
In August 2015, something strange began happening in the maternity wards in Recife in Brazil. Doctors started seeing something they'd never seen before. Newborns with normal faces up to their eyebrows, and then no foreheads. Their brains horribly malformed. Many died. It was the Zika virus. Zika was first seen in 1947 in a rhesus monkey in the Zika forest in Uganda. It moved later to the Yap Islands, to French Polynesia, just last year to Brazil and other countries. 99% of those who get it, largely from mosquito bites, have mild symptoms, some paralysis, Guillain-Barré syndrome. But it is devastating to fetuses. Donald G. McNeil Jr. covers plagues for the New York Times, and now he's crammed what he's learned about Zika into a powerful little book, Zika, the Emerging Epidemic. He joins us. Donald, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
You write, once in a while, a virus leaps out of obscurity and into headlines, Ebola, SARS, West Nile, Spanish swine, bird flu. But Zika is like no other. Why?
It's the first mosquito-borne virus that actually crosses the placenta and damages newborns or fetuses. And it's the first mosquito-borne virus that's ever also been sexually transmitted, too. And both of these are just shockers for scientists. It changes everything about how you handle a virus.
Yeah. People might wonder, well, if it was 60 years ago in other parts of the world, why weren't we seeing these terribly deformed children with microcephaly, you know, this terrible brain damage?
We might have actually seen them, except nobody noticed. It's not quite clear what happened because nobody tracked the epidemics to know how many cases spread. But also there's other causes of microcephaly in the world. There's rubella, for which there weren't shots in much of the poor parts of the world until a few years ago. There's industrial poisons. There's fetal alcohol syndrome and drug toxicity to babies. So it may have happened, just nobody was paying attention. It was when it hit those maternity wards in Brazil, in a place where a lot of people are giving birth in the hospital, which is crucial because then you have, instead of people seeing it in their homes and hiding the baby, you have suddenly doctors notice five or six kids with the same problem. And that's when you realize you have an epidemic on your hands.
Yes. You remind us that the modern day Zika epidemic is very public. And that's why it's kind of intersected with the question of whether or not women should have children. And you remind us that this happened once before in history during the German measles epidemic in the 60s.
Yeah. Basically, the rubella epidemic drove the abortion laws long before Roe v. Wade came along. I remember after I finished the book, I found an article in Life magazine that was about women who went and got abortions because they were pregnant and then they had gotten German measles during that epidemic. And there are pictures in Life magazine of women in beehive hairdos sitting up in bed waiting to see the doctor. And that created a wave of sympathy for the idea of having an abortion in the case of a grossly deformed child that made it possible in some states to make abortion, which had been illegal, legal in those cases. So it actually helped drive the laws. And there's a possibility that might happen in Latin America.
Well, it already there's been a sort of a loosening, women being urged to, use contraceptives. But tell us about this chapter of your reporting, because it's fascinating. We had no idea the behind-the-scenes fighting over when to issue travel bans, one issue, because countries' a travel ban can be a death knell if it means tourists don't go there, and when to tell women to not try to conceive. I mean, you tried to go to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to get answers on whether or not it was safe to travel to Brazil. These are people you've worked with, you've known well over the years, but you weren't getting answers. What was going on?
Well, there's two separate issues here, the travel ban and advice to avoid pregnancy.
Right.
Because a travel ban is one of the first things that states consider imposing during an epidemic. Medically, it's a relatively easy thing to do if you think it's a sensible precaution. It makes tourism ministers absolutely crazy, but it's something you absolutely have to do in order to protect your citizens from traveling to that country. On the other hand, what struck me about the epidemic was that very early on in the epidemic, health ministers in Latin America in five or six countries were asking women, please, if you can delay getting pregnant right now, please delay getting pregnant. Mm. That advice was sort of ignored in the United States because at the time in February, there was all this fuss about, you know, all these rumors that microcephaly was caused by insecticides or that it was all just a miscount by the Brazilians and stuff. And sort of under the table, there was a reporter who did an article about the suggestion that women avoid having children. And she quoted a lot of reproductive rights groups saying, we think this is outrageous, you know, that governments give this advice when they haven't provided for abortion or contraception to their countries. Mm. And my reaction was, wait, it's outrageous that they haven't provided abortion and contraception, but the advice itself is actually good advice because they know they can't control the mosquitoes. There's nothing they can do to save those women from having deformed babies, so why aren't they helping their women not become pregnant? Mm-hmm. And it became this gigantic sort of political explosion where essentially the reproductive rights groups were rejecting the advice and the infectious disease specialists were saying, no, it's good advice, and in fact, we ought to be offering it in Puerto Rico eventually. But the CDC has been absolutely reluctant to issue that advice because it's become so politically incorrect to do so. Meanwhile, in Puerto Rico, they're shoving hundreds of thousands of units of IUDs and Norplant and pills onto OBGYNs there to help women not get pregnant. But they won't say the words, don't get pregnant. It's a very odd situation.
Yeah.
And what we're finding now is that in places like Colombia, there are relatively few babies with microcephaly, considering how many hundreds of thousands of women have been infected. And the best guess is, although nobody's producing the figures, that there was a big uptick in legal and illegal abortion in the country. They're aborting children that are going to be born deformed.
Oh, not just deformed.
We assume. We don't have the data.
Right. But and we just rush to say not just deformed, but horribly deformed, in pain in many cases, and maybe not even at all functioning in many cases. But I want you to flesh out this debate a little bit more that was going on. I mean, we heard about, you know, women very angry that there wasn't abortion available for women in Brazil, and yet they were being asked to, you know, to not get pregnant. But there were other women. You talked to top officials who were, again, very reluctant to suggest to women that they not get pregnant because, for instance, what if that woman was 41 and it was her last chance?
When I spoke to a doctor who said that to me, I said, since when does a 41-year-old woman want a child that is damaged so badly that she will have to spend the rest of her life taking care of that child and you know that after her death there may be no one to care for the baby?
So you wanted more of an alarm, and maybe do you still want more of an alarm for either pregnant women or women who are of the age they can conceive?
Well, I'm a journalist, so I don't go out advocating more of an alarm or something. My job is to cover the news. But I'm mystified as to why the CDC is so reluctant to suggest to women that they consider delaying pregnancy, because it's clearly the only thing that will save those women, because mosquito control is not working, and also because the CDC is pushing contraception on women really hard but doing it under the radar in places where it has some control, as in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Well, and you also had another provocative thought. Maybe people should try to get the Zika virus.
Yeah, it's not me alone. It's some infectious disease experts think that the best vaccine for Zika is to get Zika. It's not unlike measles or chicken pox or a number of other diseases.
And of course, you're talking about people who aren't pregnant and, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. In other words, the best vaccine for Zika might be Zika itself for anyone who is not pregnant. The disease is a mild disease, even for, you know, women of childbearing age. And if they then go on to have a child, you know, a few months later, the virus probably disappears from their bloodstream within 2 weeks. And so, you know, obviously nobody suggests they get sick and then try to get pregnant within 2 weeks. But after 8 weeks or so, even the CDC believes that it's safe.
Yeah. And then you have inoculated yourself, in effect.
Yes. As far as we know, it creates long-lasting immunity. Nobody's studied the disease long enough to know if the immunity is lifelong. But as with chickenpox, as with measles, as with lots of infectious diseases, having the disease, recovering from it, and having immunity appears to be long-lasting.
And the disease, outside of the terrible damage it does to a fetus, is relatively mild, except if you run the risk of getting Guillain-Barré, which is horrific. So what about that?
Well, we all run some risk at all times of getting Guillain-Barré. You can get it after surgery. You can get it after eating undercooked chicken. You can get it after a bad cold or a bad fever, a bad stomach virus. We have about a 1 in 100,000 chance of Guillain-Barré at all times. So, yes, this virus does raise the risk of Guillain-Barré. It raises the odds to about 1 in 5,000. The odds are lower for young women of childbearing age. They're higher for older men like me. I'd take that risk in a minute.
So Donald McNeil, again, somebody who's deeply reported on the Zika virus, you may have opinions of your own, but I'm going to ask, what would you say to someone who, you know, a young woman, a woman of childbearing age, who wants to know what the expert opinion that you've heard is? What's one thing you would tell her from the expert opinion that you've heard?
A woman of childbearing age, I don't think is in danger. A woman who is pregnant or might be pregnant ought to stay away from areas where the disease is being transmitted or might be being transmitted. And right now, I personally would consider that the city of Miami, not just one square mile, because mosquitoes don't know where the boundaries are and people travel with the virus in their blood. But I'm not the CDC. So I have – you know, there are doctors who agree with this point of view and I sometimes quote them in the paper.
Yeah. Donald G. McNeil, Jr. His book is Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. It really leaves nothing, no stone unturned. Donald, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And by the way, he also writes that outbreaks like Zika, Ebola before it, tend to come and go. Colombia has already declared its Zika epidemic on the wane. So if you do delay pregnancy, it may not have to be for very long. But we're curious, if you live in Florida, are you changing your childbearing plans? Are you staying out of Miami? Leave your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Pinch hitting number 13, Alex Rodriguez.
Sounds from Fenway Park during last night's Red Sox-Yankees game. Alex Rodriguez, or A-Rod, flied out in that pinch-hitting appearance, but he's expected to be in the New York lineup tonight before returning to New York tomorrow, where he will play the final game of his career. And that's a career of highs and lows. Among the highs, a World Series title and nearly 700 home runs. The lows, a one-year suspension in 2014 for using performance-enhancing drugs. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So what are your thoughts on A-Rod as he prepares to leave the game?
Well, I think that we don't have a proper mental place for A-Rod because while he is a cheat and a narcissist and preeningly self-centered and he once slapped a ball out of Bronson Arroyo's hands in the playoffs, he is the greatest player of this generation, I would say. And Jonah Carey, who's a baseball writer, made a really good point that if you took A-Rod's seasons and split, or his entire career, and split them in half, pre-Yankees and Yankees, both halves would probably make the Hall of Fame. But beyond that, we know of geniuses who are maybe horrible or difficult people. Horrible people, Henry Ford, difficult people, Virginia Woolf, right? But we still give them credit for their genius, but not so with A-Rod. It just seems like he's so unlikable, and I don't know exactly how to define likability, but I know that we like sports, so we like athletes who play sports, and once an athlete is unlikable, he becomes a lightning rod and he becomes A-Rod.
But you're saying the unlikability is about more than just steroid use?
There's the stuff that you could prove. There's the objective stuff. It just seems that he has a personality that rubs everyone the wrong way, and there have been a few good profiles of him, and I guess the trait is wanting so badly to please yet not having any of the tools to do it, which is fine if we're talking about, you know, a parent-teacher conference with a nine-year-old, but why can't we separate that from just this amazing, amazing player? Some of us can, but this is a big reason why A-Rod gets booed. You could list 15 things that A-Rod did that were little tiny slights or violations of the unwritten code of baseball, and they probably wouldn't even attach themselves to a lot of other people. But with A-Rod, people like to poke him. Plus, he made more money than anyone else, and people are resentful of that.
Do you think that he is likely to make it into the Hall of Fame? Because other big-name players who have been tainted by steroids, including Mark McGwire, Roger Clemens, Bonds, have not.
Yeah, but none of those guys actually ever served time for their crime. So it really less depends on if he deserves it than what the composition of the voters are. As the voters get younger and maybe they're less inclined to punish the cheats, we probably will see some steroid-tainted players get in. And the other thing I'd say is that as we perhaps learn to put aside the fact that while there were years that helped him, that the steroids helped him, if you take the totality of the non-steroid years, they were still unbelievably amazing. And if you have a Hall of Fame without all those guys and without Bonds, I mean, at some point it starts being the hall of very good minus the best who a cadre of people object to on emotional and moralistic grounds.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com, the daily podcast. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now to a novel Time magazine called one of this summer's must reads. It begins in 1917. 18-year-old Bea is sent away by her wealthy Jewish family after she becomes pregnant, a one-night stand. Her parents have arranged for the baby to go to an orphanage, but Bea decides to leave her under a pear tree in her uncle's orchard in Gloucester, Massachusetts, in hopes that the impoverished Irish family that steals the fruit in the dark of the night will take the baby too. Will they? Bea and we, the readers of this lovely new novel, watch and wait behind a stone wall.
They emerged from the gap in a silent swarm, tall and short, in dark, shapeless clothing, their faces and hands pale. Bea could not determine at first a leader. They carried ladders, three figures to each, held tight at their sides as they headed for the trees. They were like fairies, Bea thought, until she heard a man's voice, quiet but clear. Get off your blasted arses and up those trees. Bea positioned Aunt Vera's whistle in her hand. The ladders rose, their tops narrower than their bottoms, and Bea nearly shrieked, thinking of the tiny body, thinking she should have wrapped it in something brighter than Aunt Vera's shawl, should have set it farther out from the trunk of the tree so it would catch the moonlight, or farther in so it wouldn't get trampled.
Don't worry, it gets found. Author Anna Solomon reading the gripping beginning to Leaving Lucy Pear, which is also about the then-blossoming birth control movement and what happens when a child has two umbilical cords, the one she's born with and the one to the pear thief who finds her. Anna Solomon joins us from NPR in New York. Hi.
Hi.
I know I left out another thread in your storyline, Prohibition. The pears are stolen to make a certain mash. Why did you pick this time?
Well, you know, at first I was sort of drawn into the late teens and really the 20s, which is when most of the book takes place, for I think the reason that a lot of people are, which is really the glamour, the clothing and the art and the jazz and all of this excitement, this sort of loosening of Victorian social constraints. And then as I got deeper into it, I was more drawn to, you know, the darker side. And, you know, Prohibition on the face of it was presented as being about protecting women and children. But, you know, it was a more puritanical law in many ways than even the Puritans could have dreamt up. And as we know now, resulted in more crime and violence than it did in abstinence, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, just as striking, in the wake of World War I, there was this virulent wave of xenophobia that swept the country, which both nationalists and white supremacists in particular really used to their advantage to demonize not only immigrants, but also people with different politics, different color, different language than their own. And all this prompted, of course, a lot of anger and backlash. And so the political extremes of the time, you know, it's hard not to see a certain resonance with the time we're living in now. And the more deeply I got into it, the more I saw that it couldn't just be sort of the backdrop for my story, but that my characters' lives needed to be bound up in it and implicated.
Well, for instance, Bea is Jewish, as we said, but her mother kind of pretends that she's not,
right,
which is maybe the safer thing to do. You mentioned the fear of immigrants. We're reminded that, you know, Italians were one of the groups that was sort of limited in that Immigration Act because it was thought that Italians were stupid and would not, you know, be able to adapt to U.S. life. And you also have the anarchist movement and Sacco and Vanzetti, the two Italians who were accused of murdering two guards. They claim innocence, and it causes uprising around the world. We feel these, you know, spasms as we read.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was interested in the way in which these national and international movements are really felt on a local level, both felt and also affected by the local. And so, you know, the book revolves around this granite quarry. The granite industry was big in Gloucester, Cape Ann, Massachusetts, and a lot of places at that time. And the workers there rise up in protest of Sacco and Vanzetti's execution, as they did in many parts of the country and the world.
Yeah, and talk more about Gloucester. People are familiar with this, the piece of land that juts out into the sea. The film The Perfect Storm is about, you know, the fishing community there that's quite struggling. You grew up there. How many of the stories that you tell in the new book were things that you heard?
A fair amount of them are sort of things that I heard, but usually they're sort of things that I heard and then I took and turned sideways or inside out and used in a different way. There was one woman who I spoke with who was alive during this time in the 20s, and she talked about things like, you know, the way that the granite dust felt on her feet, which just stuck with me on that kind of sensory level. I grew up with some pear trees down beneath my house, and we did, in fact, for a few summers, at some point, all the pears would just be gone suddenly. We would wake up in the morning and they were gone. And so that piece of the book, this sort of idea of who took these pears, and they must have really needed them on some level, the mystery of that stayed with me and definitely sort of just drew me into the story.
We read in the acknowledgments that your father said that to you. Whoever took them must have needed them. And Bee's uncle says it to her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they must have needed them. And in this case, they did. This Irish family that I don't think we're giving too much away, it's right at the beginning of the book, picks up this little bundle of a newborn baby and raises her as their own. What did you want to say about those kinds of class issues that rise up when you've got a, you know, pear thieves and the child of a Jewish woman from the city?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was trying to, you know, write about people from very different backgrounds who wind up being completely entwined and in love with the same girl in very different ways, and the ways in which their class and their religions and the strictures of each of their cultures might keep them apart ordinarily, but that they're really brought here to face each other.
Yeah. You, as we said, grew up in Gloucester and are Jewish?
I am, yeah.
And so as part of your experience, because we don't think of that as a Jewish enclave.
No, it's not. It's not. In fact, I was doing a reading recently where someone came in and said, well, I don't think there are any Jews there. There wouldn't have been Jews there at this time. And I said, well, you're wrong. But but it's true that it's, you know, it's really a place that traditionally has had a lot of Italian and Irish fishermen in it and also a lot of WASPs in it. And so growing up Jewish there, I felt at once I really belonged. You know, I was born there. I had a real connection to the land and the water. You know, I had my own little dinghy that I would putt around in and I would spend time picking mussels. And I felt very much a part of it. But on the other hand, I could see that there was a way in which I didn't quite belong. And that really stuck with me. I mean, I think a lot of writers grow up with some feeling of being an outsider, even in the place where they are from. And it does cause one to observe and also to experience that feeling of alienation in a certain way and outsiderness or removal that I think allows us to write.
I'm wondering, too, about some of the other stories we hear. Are they based in truth? There's a moment where Bee is having terrible headaches. Her mother, who's, again, very officious, decides it's a buoy, you know, that's out, that's a whistling buoy. When the wind hits it, it makes a lot of noise. And so she has it removed because she can pull some strings. And a ship crashes, and some of these workers die. And then we also hear about, you know, the alcohol running, whatever it would be, rum running, whatever they were making off the coast. Are those stories that you researched?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And actually, the kind of initial seed of the book was this piece of history that I found in a history book about Cape Ann that talked about this woman who had been suffering from a, quote, nervous disorder that was being aggravated by this whistle buoy and how she used her connections with the Navy to have it taken out. So everything there wound up in fine in truth, but in my sort of novelist self, the plot wheels got churning and I was thinking, well, what if when that whistle buoy is taken out, there is a disaster, there is a consequence, and then she's responsible for that. And the fact that then she is the summer person from away makes that situation all the more tense.
Oh, yeah. You know, I always, we read the acknowledgments and we love them. And Anna Solomon, your book, Leaving Lucy Pear, is being recommended as a summer read. But it occurred to me you could jump off and we could read some of the books you read. One Summer by Bill Bryson, The Jews of Boston by Jonathan DeSarna, Ellen Smith and Scott Martin Kosofsky, The Woman's Bible by Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
Oh, yeah.
And then you also have your characters read To the Lighthouse.
Yeah, Virginia Woolf.
So we recommend, you know, maybe some of the books that inspired you. But why To the Lighthouse?
Virginia Woolf, for me, like for so many writers and people, was so influential on my consciousness as a writer, but also as a human. And I kind of credit her, too, for helping me make the shift. I had written a lot of poetry mostly. And when I was shifting to prose writing, I think that her style and her understanding of sort of the human condition helped me kind of find my voice. Bringing in To the Lighthouse in this book for me was sort of an homage to her and a way of also thinking about my character's relationship to what they were reading, which is such a pleasure to think, you know, as a reader, knowing the way in which books have moved and changed me, to then jump into my characters and how books would have done that for them is a real pleasure.
The book is Leaving Lucy Pear by Anna Solomon. Just a terrific read. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's day 6 at the Olympics in Rio, the first Olympic golf competition since the 1904 Olympics in St. Louis tees off. There's also action on the tennis court and the rugby pitch. Joining us now from Rio, NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. And Tom, let's start with the last 24 hours. What were the highlights?
Wow, it's so hard to whittle this down, Jeremy, but I'll pick a couple. Brazil men's soccer, there was a huge sigh of relief last night when Brazil not only finally scored a goal, they had had two scoreless draws prior to last night's game against Denmark, but they won. They beat Denmark 4-0, and so they'll be moving on to the quarterfinals this weekend. You also had a wonderful story about U.S. cyclist Kristen Armstrong, 43 years old today. She won the gold medal yesterday in the individual time trial. And she's the first and only cyclist to win three straight gold medals, three consecutive Olympic Games in a cycling event. She's a wonderful story and a cyclist named Armstrong who you can believe in. And then we've got Carmelo Anthony, a guy, much maligned NBA player for the New York Knicks. Carmelo Anthony helped the U.S. Men's basketball team, which isn't supposed to even lose a quarter. They were really getting roughed up by Australia. They won thanks to Carmelo's long-range shooting. And he's really emerging as the team leader, as he's been emerging recently on social issues. So it's nice to see Carmelo kind of blossoming here.
By the way, is it true that the NBA players at the Olympics are staying on a cruise ship?
I'm afraid it is. You know, they give lip service to the fact that, you know, they say, hey, we're still taking part in Olympic activities, but come on, they're on a cruise ship.
Well, tomorrow the attention is going to turn to track and field. And in that case, you've really got to start with the great Jamaican sprinter who has dominated his events in the last two Olympics.
Oh, yeah, the guy with the pose, Usain Bolt, fastest man in the world, greatest sprinter ever. No hesitation in saying that. He's a world record holder in the 100, the 200, part of the world record holding Jamaican 4x100 meter relay team. He won gold in all those events in Beijing 8 years ago, in London 4 years ago. I can attest to that. I saw both, so it is real, Jeremy. And in Rio, he's going to go for the unprecedented triple-triple. But he'll be up against some good sprinters, his own countryman Johan Blake, the American sprinter Justin Gatlin.
When you look at somebody like Bolt, and we're talking about 9 gold medals if he wins all these events again, Michael Phelps has 21 gold medals going for 22. Can you compare these athletes in different sports and how great they are?
You know, they're using different parts of their bodies and so on, but I think there are comparisons. They both have unique bodies and skills that they put to maximum use. Bolt is very tall for a top sprinter. He has long legs that can move at a high rate of speed. That's really his secret. And his huge stride and rate of stride, that combination makes him unique and the greatest sprinter ever. Phelps has a huge arm span and allows him a great advantage in propelling his body through the water. You watch him in his best event, the butterfly, and he looks like a pterodactyl rising out of the water. And he combines that arm span with a really long torso to outreach everyone. He's got big hands and feet, like paddles and flippers. So he's got a lot going on genetically. But on top of this, they've got this champion mentality, which is harder to quantify. Like most elite athletes, they have this amazing ability to relax while the world watches and allows all their natural and crafted ability to come out at the most critical times. I mean, Jeremy, athletes like this don't think like you and I. They don't think, ooh, what if I lose, or what if I embarrass myself in front of everyone? They don't think it, so they don't do it.
And now I'm not going to be able to watch Michael Phelps without thinking of a pterodactyl. but let me ask you this, Tom, because I mentioned the fact that it's the first Olympic golf event since 1904. What's that about?
Golf isn't getting a lot of love, Jeremy. And let me tell you, I'm a huge golf fan. I love to golf myself. I'm not really interested in going. You know, when 9 of the top male golfers have decided to sit out because of Zika, come on, guys, I haven't seen a mosquito for 2 weeks. You know, it just kind of takes some of the luster, some of the shine off it. I know a lot of top women will be here. But, you know, really what you're having today is a protest out at the golf course because they've torn up some environmentally sensitive areas there. I don't think golf's going to make a big splash here.
So overall, Tom, you know, we heard all about lack of readiness by Rio before the Olympics, but how are they doing at this point? I have seen, you know, pictures of green swimming pools and stuff like that, but how would you say it's going so far?
You know, you've got isolated things like that. You've got some, you know, bus problems. You've got some reports of some muggings. But my gosh, compared to what we were expecting coming in, which was essentially Armageddon, you would have to say things are going really well. We're getting up every morning. We are watching athletes do amazing things. We have not heard of any athletes getting sick from swallowing water in the water sports. So far, so good. But we're going to knock on wood.
That's NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman at the Olympics in Rio. Tom, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
And here and now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And you know, anything is better than Armageddon. I'm Robin Young. It is Here and Now.